Okay, we're beginning on the top of Ted Zayin Amud Aleph, 12 lines down. Tanya, we have a brayta. Amru alav al Shammai HaZaken. It was well known that this was the practice of Shammai HaZaken, or this was his character. Kol yamav ayochel lechvod Shabbat. He always did things. He was eating for kavod Shabbat. Matzah behema na'ah. If he found a beautiful animal, something that was special, unique item, Omer zol de Shabbat. He would dedicate it and say, I'm going to save this for Shabbat. Matzah acheret na'ah amena. If he found another animal that was even better, meniach et hashniyah. He would leave the second one, meaning he would reserve the second one for Shabbat, ochelet arishona, and then eat the first one. Aval Hillel zaken midah acheret hayta lo. Hillel had a different practice. Shekol masav l'shem shamayim. Everything he did was dedicated to heaven. Shenemar baruch Hashem yom yom. Blessed is Hashem day to day. And therefore, as Rashi notes over here, he had bitachon. He had belief that Hashem would provide him whatever it was for Shabbat, and therefore he, based on that bitachon, ate whatever came to him. And Tanya Nami Hochi, we have a similar braita that corroborates that these were the character traits of these two individuals. V'chamay omrim mechad shavach l'shavatech. From Sunday already, you should be thinking about Shabbat, and you should be reserving things and putting aside things for Shabbat. V'tilel omrim, v'tilel, following their founder, said Baruch Hashem yom yom, that Hashem gives you every day what you need. And therefore, you can eat what you have now and rely on the fact that by time Shabbat comes around, he'll provide you something else that you'll have, l'chavod Shabbat. So now there's some interesting things to discuss over here, the first of which is Rashi. Rashi notes over here that ochelet harishona, when Shammai used to eat the first one that he had set aside because he found something better, Rashi says, the eating of the first one is for kavod Shabbat, which is very interesting because you would have said that setting aside the second animal, the better one, was the kavod of Shabbat, and then he eats the first one because it's no longer necessary. Rashi says, even in the eating of the first one, that's an issue of kavod Shabbat, and Rashi probably says that because of the way that it's phrased in the view of Shammai HaZaken is kol yamav ayochel lechvod Shabbat. Whenever he ate, he was eating the kavod Shabbat. So whatever he ate, meaning here where he ate the first one, it was for kavod Shabbat because he had set aside something even better for Shabbat. That means that when he's eating during the week, it has implications on Shabbat as well, and therefore even the eating during the week is also considered to be kavod Shabbat, which is amazing. Number two is, what exactly is Hillel's opposition or disagreement with Shammai HaZaken? That's difficult to understand. Shammai HaZaken really has a concrete way to deal with this, which is that he set aside things for Shabbat in the week to the upcoming Shabbat, and therefore every time he did something, he was always thinking about Shabbat. Beit Hillel says, no, we'll rely on bitachon. So is this a fundamental machloket as to whether kavod Shabbat versus bitachon is a bigger mitzvah? And therefore Shammai says kavod Shabbat is the bigger mitzvah, and therefore do that, whereas Beit Hillel says that bitachon is a bigger mitzvah, or that's more fundamental, and therefore relying on God and showing your bitachon in God is a more important principle than setting aside for Shabbat. Is that the nature of the machlok between them? Doesn't seem that way, and it seems a little bit strange because it's almost an apples and oranges type of machloket between them. So interestingly enough, when it comes to the Aseret HaDibrot, where it says, Zachorat Yom HaShabbat HaKodesho, Rashi actually quotes the Shita of Beit Shammai or Shammai. Zachorat Yom HaShabbat HaKodesho, always remember Shabbat. To sanctify it means to set aside things for the upcoming Shabbat in the week that you are found in. The Ramban says about Rashi, I don't understand Rashi's interpretation here. Takes Rashi to task over this. He says, yes, he's quoting a Mechilta, but the Chilta is written in a Lashon Yachid, and we know from the Gemara in Beitza that that's the Shita of Shammai and not of Hillel. And why is Rashi passing like Shammai and not Hillel? And the Ramban says that the Loch is like Beit Hillel and not like Shammai, that a Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. And therefore the Ramban rejects Rashi's explanation of the Pasuk. Interesting enough, he says right after that, Al-Derech HaPshat, he says that Zachorat Yom HaShabbat Kodesho means that you do need to remember Shabbat even before Shabbat. And the way that we accomplish that daily is by saying the Shir Shel Yom. That not only is the Shir Shel Yom important, but the little introductory phrase is important, which we say, Yom Yom Rishon LeShabbat. So we're saying today is the first day towards Shabbat. Sheni LeShabbat, Shlishi LeShabbat. We are referencing the days of the week, and by enumerating their number, it's in reference to Shabbat, or in consideration of Shabbat. And there, the Ramban sees that as a kiyum d'oraita of the pasuk of Zachorat Yom HaShabbat d'kadosho, even though we pass them like Hillel, that we don't have to do what Beit Shammai did or Shammai did over here. Nevertheless, there's still this mitzvah of being maskir Shabbat during the week. Interesting enough, the Mizrahi over there, in trying to reconcile Rashi's position, explains that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, or Hillel and Shammai, don't exactly argue along the lines of what we thought. Hillel agrees if you found an item that is unusual, that you should save it for Shabbat, because unusual items don't come up very often, and therefore if you don't save it for Shabbat, you're not going to have another one come about. Hillel was speaking about more mundane items, like an animal, or meat. That's something that came up more often. And therefore, if you eat the meat today, doesn't mean you won't have meat for Shabbat or you won't have another animal for Shabbat. And that's the nature of the bitachon. But in doing such, he then narrows the machloket between them by saying that their machloket is only in items that are common, not in items that are unusual, and that, in some senses, Hillel agrees to Shammai. If that's the case, then it's much more understandable about exactly what this machloket is between them. And you find a similar thing in the Magen Avraham and Siman Reish Nun, Ot Aleph. The Magen Avraham quotes over there from the Darche Moshe, from the Ramah, and he says that the Ramah says from the Or Zeruah, Mitzvah Lachin Mahab B'Shabto. It's a mitzvah to prepare ready from Sunday the Shabbat. Kishamai. Like Shammai, v'afal pi shamru Hillel midach eret haitabo, even though it says there that Hillel argues, and therefore we would pass him like Hillel and not like Shammai, he explains that afal pi shamidach eret haitabo, even though he had a different approach, hachi perusho, this is the way to explain the Gemara, afal pi shakom asav layu l'shem shamayim, haitabo midah zot, that even though all his actions were for the shem shamayim, nevertheless, he also has this about Gam Hillel moder shemidat Beit Shammai adifa, that Beit Shammai's approach or Shammai's approach was better. And he brings a proof from a Gemara in Shabbat that seems to indicate that that's the case. And based on that, it would suggest that the Locha is like Shammai, and therefore one should have the practice like Shammai. And that would also explain Rashi and Chumash based on this unusual interpretation of how to read the Gemara, which was that Afal pi shekol ma'aseh v'yu l'shem shamayim, hayta bo midah zot. Even though he had that midah, he still didn't disagree with Shammai's approach to it. It's a very difficult reading. And he notes that the Ramban disagrees and says the halacha is not like Shammai. But he does bring other evidence to the fact that it does sound like the Or Zeruah in Siman Reish Mem Bet, as well as the fact that from the Bach and from others, that it sounds like the halacha is like Shammai. And that would also explain Rashi's interpretation in Chumash as well. And so the Magen Avraham seems to lean in favor of saying that we hold like Shammai, even though Hillel disagrees with him, because based on this interpretation, Hillel had a different midah, but that didn't discard or dismiss the fact that the approach of Shammai was a good approach, and it seems to be that the Gemara is explaining two different midot, two different character traits, not that they were mutually exclusive, and that Hillel's trait was such, but not the negation of that which Shammai said. And therefore, if Hillel agrees to even the way that Shammai conducted himself, that would mean that the halacha would be that way as well. Interestingly enough, in Rav Huttner's Pachad Yitzchak, he discusses exactly this problem, and he says it's very hard to understand the Gemara and the interpretation of the Or Zeruah brought by the Darche Moshe is a very, very strained reading of the Gemara. It doesn't sound like that. The Gemara seems to bring in Hillel to be a disagreement or to show that he had a different approach than Shammai. And he says, if the machloket simply between them was the fact that Shammai had a focus on Kavod Shabbat being a priority, and Hillel had a focus on Bitachon, and the question was which one was better to focus on or which one was more important, then the Breita would have just brought their opinions. The fact that the Breita prefaces Hillel's statement and says, Aval Hillel hazaken midah acheret haitalo, that he had a totally different midah, shekol ma'asav l'shem shamayim. That introductory phrase seems to indicate that there's something more to their machloket than just simply a difference in opinion and priorities, or what's suggested by the Darche Moshe in the name of Zeruah, that Hillel agreed with Shammai, because that's not what it sounds like from that introductory phrase. Therefore, Rav Huttner tries to suggest the source for the fact that Kol Ma'aseh Yilushim Shammayim comes from the Pasuk of B'chol Derachecha De'ehu, that you should know God in all of his ways. And he says that Pasuk ends, V'hu Yasher Orchotecha, and that when you know God in that way, he will straighten your ways, or that which you do will be considered proper. So he knows that's not true, or that's not necessary when you're doing a mitzvah. A mitzvah is self-evident that you're doing the right thing, because mitzvot, of course, are the proper thing to do. So he suggests that if that's the source for Kol Ma'aseh Yud Hashem Shemayim, that means that it's referring to things that are not a mitzvah, things that are not obvious that they are yashar. And therefore, and he says just the opposite of what the Or Zeruah suggests, is that Hillel and Shammai, when they're arguing, Shammai agrees to Hillel's position that the midah of bitachon is much better than the midah of kavod Shabbat. But you're faced with an issue, which is that when you can take an action that's an action of reshut, I have two ways to approach it. I can elevate that action to become a mitzvah because I do something that mizmuchach, that makes it absolutely clear that the action I'm taking is the kavod Shabbat. Or I can take an action that requires one to have thought and understanding as to why this is going to be transformed into a mitzvah. And so what Shammai argues is, yes, bitachon might be a better option than kavod Shabbat, But the problem with bitachon is that any action that you take, which is a mundane, secular action, that action then has to have mindset put into it in order to have the bitachon infused in it to transform it into a mitzvah or an action that is of yasher or chotecha. That, Shammai says, I'd much rather you do it l'kavod Shabbat. Because if you do it l'kavod Shabbat, it's obvious or self-evident that the secular or mundane item that you're engaging with now is being elevated to a mitzvah by the fact that you are dedicating it to Shabbat. So that in itself, he thinks, is a better approach to items that are not obviously a mitzvah, or items that are not going to be self-evident that it's a mitzvah. It's better to do something that will make it clear that you are sanctifying or you're doing something that elevates the status of the item to a mitzvah. On the other hand, Beit Hillel's approach, and that's what it means, mida acheret haitabo, he had a different approach to these types of items. So eating, according for him, for Beit Hillel, could be elevated in of itself inherently to be something that is of significance, because you can eat based on the fact that you're eating as a bitachon and Hashem, that he will provide more for you, and that he will provide for Shabbat. And so therefore you can elevate a regular mundane action into something that is nisgav, exalted, and has a sense of kedusha to it by having the right frame of mind. Rav Shammai says that's too much to ask of a person. I'd rather have them do something where it's obvious when they dedicate it for Shabbat, that by itself will elevate it, and then when I exchange it for something else, that's also part of the mitzvah of Kavod Shabbat, and therefore it's muchach that you're doing something or elevating it to shem kedusha. And in that way, it is a more fundamental machloket between them as to how to approach divrei reshut. And that's what he says, the brayta leads off, shehilal mida acheret haitabo, which is that his character was different, and this was his approach to dealing with divrei reshut, as opposed to Shammai's approach, which was a much more conservative approach, in the sense that it was only done, he did things that were obvious or muchach, that you were makdish this item, and doing something l'shem Shammaim, as opposed to Beit Hillel, who would, on a standalone basis, would be willing to, or displayed a amount of bitachon that elevated the object or the divrei reshut, even without that context of Kavod Shabbat. So that's a nice or beautiful explanation that's given by Rav Huttner in the Pachad Yitzchak and his writings on Shabbat in Mamar Yud. So just in summary, l'alocha, we do follow, quote-unquote, Shammai's position, first of all, with regards to the Yom, in the fact that we mention Shabbat every day in the Yom, and the Ramban says that that's basic out of the Pasuk and not even Shammai's position. It's important to note that those people that say the Shir Shayom of the Gra, which then doesn't conform to the day of the week, there's still an inyan to say Hayom Yom. So even like on Yom Kippur, where Mizmor Lamed Bet is the Mizmor for Yom Kippur according to the Gra, nevertheless, you should still say Yom Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat, because that in of itself is a mitzvah to anchor the day in relationship to Shabbat, even though you don't finish with the latter part of the statement, which is Shabbat Yom Alevim Amrim B'Beit HaMikdash, because it's not what they said. So you say Yom Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat, and then you can just say the Shir Shayom. That's number one. Number two is from the Magen Avram, and from some of the Achronim, it seems pretty clear that they think that Beit Shammai, or Shammai's position, is held to Alocha, unlike the Ramban, and therefore they say that there is a value in preparing for Shabbat earlier in the week, and someone should take that into consideration when preparing for Shabbat. Someone who gifts something to their friend, ain't tzarich lo'odio. You don't have to notify them that you gifted them something. Shenemar, how do we know this? From the Pasuk in the Torah, Moshe lo yadaki karan or panav. Moshe descends from Har Sinai. He doesn't know that he has this radiating glow or aura about him until he's informed by the people or the people backing away from him once he comes down from Har Sinai. Meitavei, is that really true? The Pasuk in Parshat Kitisa says with regards to Shabbat, Vayomer Shem Moshe Lemor Vatata Ber El Bnei Yisrael Lemor Ach Et Shabtutai Tishmoru Ki Od Hi Beini Uveneichem Ledoritechem Ladat Ki Ani Hashem Ekadishchem. So it says there, Ladat, that you should know that I sanctified you. And from that, Amar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Moshe Matana Tova Yesh Li Bebeit Genzai, I have in my treasure stores this great gift, the Shabbat Shema. And it's called Shabbat. V'ani mevakesh l'itnal Yisrael. I want to gift it to Bnei Yisrael. Lech v'odia otam. Go inform them that the fact that I'm going to gift them to them. Mikanamar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So from here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel learns a normative practice, which is a notein pat l'tinok, someone who gives a gift to a child, candy, or here it's a piece of bread. Tzarich l'odia l'imo. You have to let his mother know that you did that. So there you see that you do have to let someone know or inform someone that you have gifted them. Rashi over here has an interesting note as to why it is that you have to let them know. He says, Mitokach, once you inform the person about the gifting, Yedu avivi imo shuha avem, that the parents will know that this other person is someone who thinks highly of them or cares about them, and therefore he's gifting their child something. If they give something to the child and the child eats it up and then nobody knows about it, that won't produce more goodwill between the different parties because they're unaware of the fact that it happened. Might be nice that the person is doing something for this child, but on the other hand, it's his parents that are really important because that will create much more of a positive reinforcement of goodwill towards different parties and increase the ava between different parties. It's similar to Mishloach Manot on Purim, which are to engender Mishloach Manot, Ishtereyu, good feelings and goodwill between parties. So that'd be the same thing over here. So how come we have this stira where Moshe wasn't informed, yet Hashem tells Moshe to inform Bnei Yisrael about Shabbat? So Lokasha, that's not a problem. Ha b'matana David ali gluye. When a gift is going in the end become known, here God gifted this aura to Moshe Rabbeinu. So even though Moshe was not aware of it, as soon as he came down and the people saw him and backed away, he'd know about it. He'd be informed about it. So that's something you don't need to inform because that person will find out in the end anyway. Ha b'matana dulavi dili gluye. On a present that will not obviously not become known. Over here, the child will consume the food before he gets home and the parents will never know about it. So there, you have to inform the people. And similarly, with regards to Shabbat, Hashem wants Bnei Yisrael to know that he's about to gift them with Shabbat, or this special gift. Shemar says, Shabbat nami matana David aligluye. Wait a minute. If you have to keep Shabbat, and Hashem gives them all the principles of Shabbat, they're going to know what the gift of Shabbat is as well. So what do you mean that it's not something that in the future will be well known or become apparent? It's something also that will become apparent, and why did Hashem have to inform Bnei Yisrael beforehand? Where it says, matan schara lo avida aligluye. The reward for keeping Shabbat, the way that the Marsha says it is, lo'olam haba, that reward is so great and something so special that Hashem never informed Bnei Yisrael about that. That's something that would not become obvious or be known to them. And therefore, yes, Shabbat would be known to them, but Hashem wanted Moshe to tell them not only about Shabbat, but also about the reward for keeping Shabbat and the benefits of keeping Shabbat. So Amar Mar, so now the Gemara goes back to discuss this further. You have to let his mother know that he gifted him something. My ovidle, what do you do to give that indication? Shaifle mishcha umalile kochla. You put some oil in his hair, on his forehead, or you put some eye coloration in his eye. So it would be something that where the mother sees it and says, who did that to you? And the child will say, well, so-and-so did it to me, and he also gave me this bread, he also gave me this gift. So that way, the person will know that the gift was given, and you do something to the child, which will be a talking point when the parent sees the child. Va'idna d'chashina n'kshafim. Today that we worry about witchcraft and sorcery, people doing these things to children, and therefore it would not be appropriate to do this to a child. My, then how do you indicate to, or you let the parents know that you gifted something to the child? Rapapa shayifle ma'otamin. You plaster some of whatever you gave it to him on him. In the modern parlance, that would be, is you smear some chocolate on his forehead, you put some cookie crumbs in his hair, and something that would make it obvious that he engaged with something that the parents were not expecting, and therefore they're going to ask him, or they're going to query of him, why do you have this chocolate on your forehead? And say, oh, so-and-so gave me chocolate, or why do you have these crumbs in your hair? Ah, because I got a cookie from so-and-so. So that would be the way that you inform, but it's important to inform because of the goodwill that's created. And therefore, it's important for people to know that they got a gift. I'm Rabbi Yochanan Mishum, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So Rabbi Yochanan says, in the name of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, we note this many times, that Mishum means that the person didn't see that person, because Rabbi Yochanan was first generation Amor in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is a Tana before the time of Rabbi, and Rabbi Yochanan was a youngster in Rabbi Shir, so it's unlikely that Rabbi Yochanan actually interacted with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And so the Balei Tosafot note that Mishum means that he had a mesorah from Hashem Bar Yochai, but he didn't necessarily hear it directly. All the mitzvot that God gave to Bnei Yisrael were done publicly. The exception of Shabbat, which was given in privacy or privately. Because it is a sign between me and them. It's a private sign. It's a special or unique bond between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael. The Gemara says then, Ihoki lo la'anshu nachrim ala de Shabbat. So then why should the nachrim be punished for not keeping Shabbat? So this is a very difficult statement in the Gemara, mostly because of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says that a nachri shishabbat, nachri that keeps Shabbat, is chayav mita. So then how can you hold them accountable for not keeping Shabbat? Because if they do keep Shabbat, they're chayav mita. So how do I reconcile between the fact that they're going to be held accountable for not keeping Shabbat versus the fact that if they keep Shabbat, now they're in trouble? The way Rashi reconciles it is to suggest that when Hashem offered the Torah to the non-Jews, which is found in Parshat Zota Brachat, says, Arach Mesir Lamo, Fiyah Mehar Paran, over there the Midrash explains that Hashem offered the different nations the Torah and they each rejected it. Now, that's interesting only because the items that are mentioned in that Midrash, none of them mention Shabbat. So Rashi is assuming that Hashem offered them all these different things and included what was in the Torah. In the Midrash, it just mentions the items that they were challenged by. Otherwise, do not steal, do not murder, do not commit adultery. Those were the challenges for those nations, and therefore Hashem presents that as the mitzvah that they'd have to keep, and they reject it because they didn't want that particular restriction. But it never mentions that Hashem offered them the whole Torah or specified them to Shabbat. But Rashi's assumption is that that was included and they knew about it then, and their rejection of Shabbat, they're going to be held accountable for not taking the Torah or not accepting the Torah. Even though now, once they rejected it, they can't keep Shabbat. Nevertheless, the original rejection they'll be held accountable for. And that's the Gemara's question over here. How can you hold them accountable if it's a private gift between God and Bnei Israel? That means that they didn't know about it. They weren't informed about it at that time that they were given the Torah. That's the way Rashi deals with it. The Marsha, interestingly, quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin and suggests that's the nature of the Gemara's question. How can you hold them accountable for Nachrish Shavat b'chayav mita, Elim Kain, they knew about it? If they didn't know about it, and from a logic standpoint, they came to it on their own and wanted to keep Shabbat, why should they be chayav mita? The fact that you say they're chayav mita shows you that they must have been informed about it, and then when they're keeping Shabbat, they're keeping it because that's what the Torah says. If they do that, that's problematic, and that's what the Gemara in Sanhedrin is saying. But that Gemara indicates that they had to be informed, because if they did it of their own volition, that wouldn't be something that you could hold them accountable for, punish them for. It actually be something positive. And so that's how he reads the question over here. Or the way that others suggested is that the non-Jews that compel the Jews to work on Shabbat, how can you hold them accountable for forcing the Jews to work on Shabbat if they're not informed of the fact that Jews have to keep Shabbat or aware of that fact? So the Gemara amends this a little bit and says, no, Odia Odinu, they did get informed about Shabbat, Matan Schara Lo Odinu, but the gift, the reward for Shabbat was not given to them, meaning that the Shabbat that was given to Bnei Israel was done publicly and was known to the other nations and was offered to them when they were offered the Torah. Nevertheless, the reward for Shabbat was never given to them, and that's Oti B'ni Uvim Bnei Israel. That's a private thing between me and Bnei Israel. Even the reward for keeping Shabbat was something that was done publicly and disclosed to them, and the non-Jews were informed of it as well. But what they were not informed about is Neshama Yetera Lo Yedinu. The fact that you have a Neshama Yetera, the extra Neshama, on Shabbat. Damar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Neshama Yetera, Notena Kosh Baruch Hu Badam Erev Shabbat. That Erev Shabbat, meaning when you enter in Shabbat, a person has a Neshama Yetera that comes in. In the Kabbalistic view, that's part of the process of Kabbalat Shabbat, is also the Kabbalah of the Neshama Yetera that you take in or welcome the Neshama Yetera that the person is going to get over Shabbat. U'motzei Shabbat, notlim oto imenu. And then a Motzei Shabbat, it leaves him, and that's the reason for smelling Besamim on Motzei Shabbat. It's a way to comfort the individual for the loss of Neshama Yetera, Reicha, or smell, which is considered to be an elevated spiritual sense of the individual. There we try to stimulate that sense as a way to mitigate the loss of Neshama Yetera, and that's why we smell the samim on Motzei Shabbat. Shenemar, and how we know this is the case, because it says, Shabbat Vayinafash. You keep Shabbat, and then Vayinafash. And they read Vayinafash, came into Shabbat, after you have Shabbat, Vay Avda Nefesh. Woe, because I've lost the Nefesh, I've lost this extra Neshama Yetera. Vayinafash is an indication of the loss that happens after the keeping of Shabbat or the Neshama Yetera that leaves. What exactly this Neshama Yetera is interesting. Rashi claims over here, Rochav Lev Lemnucha. It's the ability to accept the physical onslaught that happens on Shabbat. All that extra rest, Ulesimcha, and all that enjoyment, Liot Patuach Lirvacha, that you'll be open to all these quote-unquote goodies, V'yochal V'yishteh, you'll eat more than normal, you drink more than normal, V'nafsho Katzalav, and your body doesn't reject it. Meaning that Rashi sees it as a very physical manifestation that the Neshama Yetera also gives the person the ability to deal with it or to handle the physical enhancement that is done to Shabbat with all the good foods, all the extra rest, and all that a person does, that won't make him sick or they won't be able to handle it. The Neshama Yetera gives them the ability to deal with it or to handle those special parts of Shabbat. And the Rabbeinu Chananel says something similar, where he says, "Klomar kosh nivru ba'olam litaneg mehen nishmatan b'yom ha'shvi nivru'u umit ravchot umit gadlot b'shabbat." They expand and they are greater on Shabbat. Kevin sheshavad havai avda nefesh klomar nitmata ha'nishama. That once Shabbat leaves, the neshama is then reduced. So the neshama is able to expand or to increase its capacity to be able to enjoy, partake of the pleasures. That's something that when you have a neshama, it expands or increases its capacity to deal with that on Shabbat. When Shabbat leaves, it's reduced. There are other Rishonim, like the Shita Mekubetzet and the Meiri, who take just the opposite approach, and seems to be, when you're talking about a neshama yeteri, you're talking about a spiritual item, would seem to be a more appropriate way to explain it, a more becoming explanation, which is that it's just the opposite way around. During the rest of the week, the person is steeped in the mundane and the physical world, and therefore his neshama, his spiritual side, doesn't get a chance to express itself or to enjoy itself. Once Shabbat comes, the reduction in the physical labor and the engagement in the physical world then lets the neshama yetera take over, meaning that allows his neshama to expand and revel in the rest from the physical and revel in the spiritual side of Shabbat. That means that he's then free to do more learning and to engage in more spiritual activities, which will please the neshama. And that's what it means there's a neshama yetera. The neshama gets extra attention, or it has more time to be fed, quote-unquote, on Shabbat. Not in the physical sense, but in the spiritual sense. Right now, the Gemara, after this Agadata, goes back to dealing with Eruv Tavshilin. And it says over here, Oseh Adam Tavshil Me'erev Yom Tov. That a person has to cook one item on Erev Yom Tov, on which he's someich to then cook on Yom Tov itself for Shabbat. It has to be an item that's a cooked item of alpat lo. But you can't use bread as the item to be the Eruv Tavshilin. Why can't you use bread? You need something that accompanies bread to be used as your Eruv Tavshilin. And bread can't be something that accompanies because it is a staple product. And the way that Rashi explains it over here is because you need a liftam b'inan muchacha milta shasu the Shabbat. You need something that's obvious that you're preparing it for Shabbat. They ate bread all week long. And the enhancement of Shabbat, or the way that you knew it was Shabbat or Yom Tov, was that they added other dishes to accompany the pot. The bread was very hard and many times stale, and they had many dips and all sorts of other accompaniments to enhance the bread. So that was especially true on Yom Tov and Shabbat. But if you make bread on Erev Yom Tov for Shabbat, that's no different, or it's not clear that you're doing that specifically for Yom Tov Shabbat, because bread was a staple product every day of the week. So you have to do something that accompanies the pot in order that it be unique or special or something that's not common to the everyday. And through that, it'll be muchamilta. It'll be obvious that you're preparing for Shabbat before Yom Tov and not just simply preparing like a regular weekday. So the Gemara says, if that's the reasoning, that you need something that accompanies bread and not bread itself, v'ha'daisa nami delo melafto, even though daisa, which is like a farina made out of barley and wheat, even though it's not an accompaniment for bread, meaning that it's a filling product in itself, it's considered to be a staple product. Amar Rabbi Zera, ani bavlai tipshai. Rabbi Zera, who interestingly enough came from Bavel and then made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael, says those foolish Babylonians, da'achle nema benema. They eat bread together with bread. I mean, his reference is the fact that they eat daisa along with their bread. So they're eating two products that are like bread or bread-like products together. So you see that daisa is not an accompaniment to bread, or it's not proper to accompany the bread because it could be a meal in of itself, or it's a product that you would eat normally in of itself. Nevertheless, you're allowed to use that for an Erev Tavshilin. So you see, even though the fact that daisa is not appropriate, or it's not malafet the pot, doesn't accompany bread, as Rabbi Zera says that these foolish Babylonians did do that, which was silly because they're eating bread with bread, then that's not a normal item to accompany bread. And despite that fact, you're allowed to use it for Erev Tavshilin. So that can't be the reasoning why you can't use pot. Elamide de lo shchiach be'inan. We need something that's unusual. Pot shchicha, but daisa lo shchicha. Bread is very common. Again, it's a staple product. It's something that was eaten every day. And therefore, it's not unusual. It won't be any indication that you're doing something specially for Shabbat. Daisa, on the other hand, was an unusual dish. It didn't happen every day, or they didn't eat it every day. If you make that, that's something unusual. And that's the key element. Make something that's not normal, something that's unusual, something that's dedicated towards Shabbat and Yom Tov. Pot doesn't fill that criteria, and therefore it can't be used for Erev Tavshilin. Igadamre, there's another version of this discussion. Amar Abaye, lo shanu elo tavshil, of apat lo. Begins with the same statement of Abaye, which is that tavshil, a cooked item, is good for erev tavshilin. Pat is not good for erev tavshilin. My time, what's the reasoning? If you tell me it's something that's not common that you need, upat shchicha, and bread is a common item, and therefore it's not considered to be good for erev tavshilin, vadaisa lo shchicha, when it comes to daisa, it's something that's not common. So this is the difference in this lashon. Over here, we have a member from Abaye that says daisa is not good to be used as an erev tavshilin. So you can't tell me that it has to do with whether it's common or not common, because even though daisa is not common, you're not allowed to use it for an erev tavshilin. So he goes to the other side now, meaning to the havamino of the previous version of the Gemara, is now the conclusion over here, and vice versa. The conclusion over here is the havamino of the previous Gemara, and they're just switching because it has to do with whether daisa is good or not good. So daisa is the pivotal factor in determining whether shchiach is the real reason or not the real reason. If you think you can use daisa, then lo shchiach is the reason that erev tavshilin works, and daisa works as well. If you say daisa doesn't work, then the reasoning must be that you're melafet et apat, and daisa is not appropriate to melafet et apat. And that's what the Gemara says here. Lamida de melafet binan upat lo melafto, the daisa nami lo melafto. Pat doesn't accompany something, and neither does daisa. They're both main dishes or staple products that are not additive on top of the bread to make it mukha milta, as Rashi says, that you're doing this specifically for Shabbat. It's not a malafet in a pot, because it's a silly thing that these Babylonians do, that they dice it together with pot, meaning that it's not appropriate or it's not an accompaniment to pot, because it's pot in of itself. Tani, Rabbi Chia, atashim shebishulei akteira, somerech aleihem mishum erivei tavshilin. Rabbi Chia says that if you have, at the bottom of the pot, you have some burnt or leftover lentils, you can use that or rely on that for your erev tavshilin. V'hani milei titbu kazayit. That's as long as they meet the minimum threshold of a kazayit, then they're good to be used as an erev tavshilin. Am Rabbi Yitzchak Breit Rav Yehuda, shamnunit shel gabi asakin. The fat that is on the knife, the residue that's on the knife from cutting fatty items, go to roll, you can scrape it off, and you can use that for an erev tavshilin. V'hani milei, again, the qualification is titbu kazayit, that it meets the minimum standard of a kazayit. Now, both of these statements say somechalav, that he's allowed to use it for erev tavshilin, which indicates it's not lechatchila, it seems to be a bidyavad situation, and that's because these aren't items that you would consider to be special, unique for Shabbat, in the sense that you're doing the bottom of the pot or the leftover fats. Those are items that are basically the dregs or the leftovers of some other cooking that you did, so we wouldn't suggest lechatchila that you use that for erev tavshilin, but if you ever have it and you rely on that to be your erev tavshilin, it will work to be your Eruv Tavshilin. So Amarav Asi, Amarav, Dagim Tanim Luchim, if you have small salted fish, Imbem Mishulei Nachrim, it's not a problem for non-Jews to cook them. That is because they are edible in that state. And these fish that were salted, so you have things like sardines or herring, whereby the fish isn't cooked but salted and it's edible in that state. Since it's edible in that state, if the goy then cooks it for you afterwards, that's not a problem of Bishulakum. Now, there could be two reasons for that. One reason is because koshen echal chai, anything that's eaten in its raw state, then there's no din of bishul akum with that, and that's what Rashi quotes. Ashen echal kamoshu chai lo gazru al bishulo. So that's what Rashi claims is the reason. The Rabbeinu Chanano claims that the reason is koshen olel shulchan melachim lo lafeit bo etapat. Anything that doesn't go on a table of royalty, meaning that it's a food that's considered to be significant enough that you put it on a table of royalty, that's something that doesn't have bishulei akum. And since these small fish were not placed on tables of kings, they were considered to be a poor man's food, therefore there's no din of bishulakum in them because they just don't meet that threshold that we worry about the goy preparing them and then causing social relations that will then end up in chatnot, in intermarriage. Tosfot on the Amud Bet also asks why Rashi only brought the issue of nechal chai and doesn't mention the fact that the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that they're not ole al-shulchan melachim, lefeto adapat. So those what it says, it depends on the size of the fish. Fish that are very small or tiny, those are considered to be poor man's food, and therefore they don't go on shulchan melachim, and that's what the Gemara in Avodah Zarah was speaking about, why those don't have a problem bishulakum. The fish that we're speaking about here are slightly larger fish that do go on shulchan melachim, or at least sometimes go on shulchan melachim, and that's an important distinction, because in order to not have bishulakum, it has to be something that's not served on president's table. If you went to a dinner with the president or a lunch with the president, they weren't served this. So that's true if they don't serve it at all. But if they would sometimes serve it, it would be considered to be a delicacy of some sort that they would put on the table, then it doesn't meet that qualification. And also it says that's the threshold. Very small fish are poor man's food. Medium-sized fish or slightly bigger fish, even though they're salted fish, they are considered to be a delicacy of sort, and they would be put on Shulchan Melachim. Therefore, the reason they're not subject to Bishul Akum is because they don't need to be cooked. They can be eaten in their raw state. And so cooking them doesn't make them any more prepared than they already are at this point in time. Just as a side note, that's what the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, we pass in like Poshito the Kula, which means that either if it doesn't go on Shulchan Melachim or it's eaten in its raw state, either of those negate the problem of Bishul Akum. So if either one of those is true, then there's no problem of Bishul Akum. If neither of them are true, then there is a problem of Bishul Akum. I'm Rav Yosef. If a Nachri roasted the salted fish, you can use it for Erev Tavshilin. So it turned out to be really a mutually exclusive type of position, which is that there's no Bishul Akum because they can be eaten in their raw state. Nevertheless, the fact that the Goy roasted them or cooked them makes them that they are Tavshilin, and therefore they can be used for Erev Tavshilin. So they'll be considered to be Mvushal for Erev Tavshilin. They will not be considered Mvushal for Bishul Akum, and that's the Chiddush over here. V'yavdinu Nachri Kasa Daharsina, if he makes it into a dish, a fish hash, in which there's oil, these small fish, and flour, asur, then it's problematic. Then there is a problem with Bishul Akum. Where it says Pshita. Of course there's a problem with Bishul Akum now, because one of the ingredients in the fish hash is flour. And flour cannot be eaten in its raw state. It needs to be processed or cooked in order for it to be edible. And therefore, they're subject to Bishul Akum. And so therefore, it's obvious that this would be a problem with Bishul Akum if he made this kasa d'harsana. So where it says, ma'u d'tema harsana ikar, you would have thought that the fish is the main ingredient here, and not the flour, and the fish fat and the oils and the fish itself are the major part of this fish hash, and not the flour. The flour is just maybe a thickening agent or something that is an additive, but not the main ingredient. So there wouldn't be a problem with Bishul Akum, because the fish could have been eaten in its raw state. Kamash Malon, that Kimcha Ikar, that the flour is considered to be the staple or main product here, and because of that, it's classified as Bishul Akum. If it's Bishul Akum, then it can't be an Erev Tavshilin because you can't eat it at all. It's something that would be restricted in being eaten because it's subject to a Yisur D'Rabbanan of Bishul Akum. So we're just going to finish up the Gemara to the two dots, and then we'll quickly go and look at the Baal HaTosafot. We have some important Chidushim over here. Amar Rabbi Abba, Eruvei Tavshilin Tzrichin Kizayit. Erev Tavshilin require a minimum of a Kizayit, as we saw before in the previous Amud. Yibaylo Kizayit Echad L'Kulan. When you say it has a minimum of Kizayit, is that one Kizayit for everybody to rely on? I mean, the whole household can rely on one kezayit. Or maybe every person that wants to rely on the Erev Tavshilin needs to have a kezayit that is a part of this. So you'd have to have multiple kezayitim in order to have multiple people be yotze or be able to use or rely on this Erev Tavshilin. Tashma, domi Rabbi Abba, marav, eruvei Tavshilin, tzrichin kezayit, ben le'achad, ben le'meyah. So we have an explicit statement in the name of Rav that Erev Tavshilin requires a kezayit when you're doing it for one person or 100 people. Kezayit is the threshold, and there's no other requirement, or there's no need to add for additional people. Now, the Baal HaTosafot point out, therefore, we have three different Eruvin. We have Erev Tchumim, Erev Chatzerot, and Erev Tavshilin, and they all have different dinim with regards to what their minimum shiur is. And that is, Erev Tchumim requires shtei su'udot, kol echad ve'echad. Anybody who wants to rely on this Erev Tchumim needs to have two su'udot put down for them, because it's as if they're standing there, making their house in that new location. And so each person needs to have enough food that it's classified as their makom shvita. And so each person requires shtei su'udot in order to be functional for them. Then you have an erev chatzerot, where there you need a grogeret. You need the amount of a dried fig for each individual. But there is a maximum, which is that once you reach shtei su'udot, then you don't have to add any more. So each person requires a grogeret for eruvei chatzerot. And then once you reach the threshold of shtei su'udot, you can add as many people as you want without any problem. And that's why most places, when they make an eruv chatzerot, they use a box of matzo, which qualifies for shtei su'udot. It can include any number of people in the eruv chatzerot. Now when it comes to eruv tavshilin, you just simply need a kezayit, right? That's what says here, the whole min v'min of every item. I think it means you only need one item. You only need one tavshil in order to do that. But whatever you use, you need to have a kezayit worth of that item, minimum and maximum, and that will be sufficient to have Erev Tavshilin. So in that way, you have three different qualifications for all the different Eruvim, depending on what they're trying to do or what they're trying to accomplish. The Tosfot over here mentions That their practice was to buy bread that was kneaded with eggs that they call kantvash be oblash. The mainechush. He says, what's the problem here? Imishum pat atzmo. If it's a problem of pat akum, hetiru chachamim. The chachamim were matir it. Now that's not totally true. The chachamim were matir pat akum when it's pat plater, when it's done on a commercial level, when it's not done on a house or domestic level. But if it's sold on a commercial basis, then pat is not a problem of pat akum. That's a heter that's used still till today. In terms of if you go into the stores and you find a heksher on bread that's in the stores that's not Jewish bread, that's because it's pat palter. It's something that's a commercially sold bread, and it's not a problem because of that, at least b'diavad. The chatchila, maybe you still should have pat Yisrael. But nevertheless, Tosfot says, this is not a problem of pat akum, because that's already gone by the wayside in terms of pat palter. And imishum beitzim, what about this bishul akum? Eggs can't be eaten raw, and now the eggs are being cooked, baked along with the bread. So why isn't that a problem? Shoshoguba amrinan kimcha ikar. We just said in the statement before that the flour is the major ingredient. So by fish ash, that turns out to be the chumrah, that the flour is the major ingredient. By bread, it turns out to be the kula, because there's no problem of pat akum by flour. So since the flour is the major ingredient, it's considered to be pat and not beitza. If that's the case, then there's no issue of bishul akum. He says, for that reason, we eat these items, we buy these items from the non-Jews without any problem. Then Tosfot tries to deal with other issues with regards to the eggs. How do you know they're kosher eggs and not non-kosher eggs? So Tosfot says that in our regions or where we live, the only eggs that people are using are kosher eggs and not non-kosher eggs. In other places, the Baal Tosfot note that the cost of non-kosher eggs is such a premium that nobody would use it commercially because they would lose money by using non-kosher eggs. Kosher eggs are the most commonly found, the cheapest eggs to use. And therefore, we can assume that those are the eggs that are in this bread. Number two, he says, what about the fact that there might be a blood spot in the egg? So Tosfot says, rove of eggs, majority of eggs that are brought to market are either not fertilized, or if they are fertilized, they are taken out before they ever develop. And therefore, a blood spot is very unusual, and you don't have to be choshesh for it. So Tosfot says, well, then I'm telling you it's a rove and we don't have to be choshesh for it, then why do we check eggs for blood spots? He says, don't worry about that. That's just a chumra ba'alma that we want to be sure. It's something that you can check. So even though you could rely on the rove after the fact, if it was already beaten in the egg, or if the goy already put the egg in, you can rely on that rove. Nevertheless, if we have the opportunity to check beforehand, why not check? Because then you can eliminate the eggs that are that might miut without too much trouble. And therefore he says it's a chumra ba'alma, but in Ochanami, you wouldn't really worry about it because it is a rove that most eggs do not have blood spots in them. And even though there's a principle you're not allowed to buy beaten eggs from a non-Jew, because the assumption is the reason that it's a beit zayt shufa, it's a beaten or smushed egg, is because it was a nevela, or it came from a trefa, or it was a non-kosher egg. That, he says, is true only when the egg is independent, when it's by itself. Because then there's circumstantial evidence. The fact that it's a beit zayt shufa already indicates that there must have been something wrong with it, or a Jew sold it to the non-Jew, sold it because it was a nevela or a trefa, and now he's trying to resell it to you. So once it's a trufa, we don't allow you to buy it. But that's only when it's standing independently. But if it's part of the recipe that they're putting in beit zayt trufot, that's not beaten eggs because of the fact that it was a problematic egg. That's because that's the way they put the eggs into the bread. And therefore, we wouldn't be choshesh for the fact that it is problematic, or this egg is from a non-kosher animal, or more importantly, from a kosher animal that was a trefa or a nevela, because those eggs are also problematic. Then Tosfot speaks about a pashtitz, which was a similar bread that was stuffed with fish fat, and the fish fat then seeped into all the bread around it. And Tosfot says that we can't buy from the Nachrim, because that's a problem with bishul akum. And even though the pat might be the ikar over here, because of the fish, which is a problem with bishul akum, now penetrated all parts of the bread, that's going to cause a problem because its flavor is everywhere, and it's also seeped into the other parts of the bread, and therefore it's going to be a problem of bishul akum. We can't buy that from the non-Jews. And he says, even though bread ain't bo mishum bishul nochrim, meaning the pat akum is not a problem, and anything that's not be'en, that's not obviously in mamashut, is physically there, is also not a problem. And over here, the fish fats now, or oils, got absorbed into the bread, so it shouldn't be a problem. He says, kodem shenivla ba'isa, before it was absorbed into the bread, be'en, it was whole, be'en nesar, and it became a sur during that cooking process. So that the bread is then kneaded or baked together with something that's a sur. So since the fish was cooked separately and had bishul akum associated with it, that makes it into a devar asur. And that devar asur, now when you add it in, it penetrates the bread. The devar asur doesn't go away when you add it later. As opposed to the eggs that we were discussing before, they were kneaded into the bread from the outset. And therefore, they weren't asurim. And the bishul was a bishul of bread or a pat akum. And that's not a problem. Over here, something that was already bishul akum is now being placed into the pot. So now, even though now it dissolves and disanimates throughout the bread and it's not banned anymore, but it's isser, and isser is now flavoring the whole bread and it's problematic. But he does mention that there are some people, yeshim esirim ashuman, there's some people who take out this fat, vochlim otobi gaya gavna, and then they eat it in that way. Not exactly sure how they get all that flavor, all that fat out, but seems to be that they were able to do that and then eat it. Then he brings another dish, nilush, that since we don't make hamotzi on it, then there is a problem of bishul akum there, or pat akum, because then we can't say kimcha ikar. If kimcha was ikar, then you make hamotzi on it, and you would not make mizonot on it. The fact that you make mizonot shows that the kimcha is not ikar. But then he brings from the Rabbeinu Ichio that he thinks that that's wrong. Since he bakes it in the way that bread is normally baked, and even though it doesn't attain the status of hamotzi, nevertheless, that mizonot is like bread, and therefore kimcha ikar, and it have a status like pat akum. And he says especially for the fact that if you were kovei asud on it, it's pat ababakistin, and you were kovei asud on it, you'd have to make hamotzi and bench on it. That makes it already that it's classified like pat, and therefore it would be pat akum and not bishul akum, and it would be mutar to eat it. So very interesting Tosfot, and as we note in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah many times, Tosfot was dealing with the reality in which they interacted with their non-Jewish neighbors in a significant manner, and they really were dependent on them for much of their food and for their supplies, and therefore they had to come up with ways to have it that bishul akum or pat akum was not going to be a problem, otherwise they didn't have baked goods, or they didn't have bakeries there that were Jewish bakeries, and therefore they come up with these kulot, or they discuss these kulot, both here and with regards to wine, in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, and it's interesting just to note it here, based on our Gemara here, that Tosfot says, Kimcha Ikar has a tzad the kula, not just the chumra. Right now, to continue with the Gemara, it's not achlo o she'avad, if they ate the Erev Tavshilin, or it was lost, lo yivashel alav b'tchila, you can't then use it to cook on Yom Tov for Shabbat. Sher mimeno koshu sumechalav. If there's anything that's left over from it, you can rely on it le Shabbat in order to cook. My koshu. What does it mean that there's anything left over? Lav avagav deleka kizayit. Doesn't it sound like even if there's less than a kizayit, you could use it? Lo, deed pe kizayit. Because if there's less than a kizayit, that would go against what we said before, that there's a minimum threshold of a kizayit for Erev Tavshilin. Here it would sound like that's not the case. It would sound like you can even use the smallest amount. So the Gemara comes along and says, no, koshu doesn't mean literally a koshu. Koshu means a kazayit. As Rashi notes over here, it's relative to a whole loaf of bread. To a whole loaf of bread, a kazayit is considered like a koshu. So that's a koshu compared to something that's a full item. But nevertheless, it still has to meet that minimum threshold of a kazayit. Tashma, tafshil zetzli. The tafshil that you use could be even something that's roasted, bafilu kavush, or even something that is pickled, shaluk, or something that's very heavily cooked, umivushal, or something that's cooked regularly. All of those types of preparations are considered good for creating something that's an Erev Tavshilin. Kulios aspanim, and this fish, which was a fish that was heavily salted, and had a very thin skin, and they used to prepare it, shetantan alav chamim, Erev Yom Tov, if you pour hot water on it, you had to pour the hot water to get rid of the salt that was on it, and it's what's called a kaleya bishul. Just with the hot water that's poured on it, it becomes fully edible at that point in time. So if you did that on Erev Yom Tov, then you can rely on that for Erev Tavshilin, because that's considered to be bishulo. When you pour the hot water on it to wash off the salt, and that cooks, quote-unquote, the fish, that is considered to be the cooking of the fish, and that can be relied on for an Erev Tavshilin. Tchilato, and this is what we're after in the Braita, which is Tchilato v'sofo ein lo shiur. The beginning and the end of this Erev Tavshilin don't have any minimum standard. My love ein lo shiur klau, has no shiur at all, and there would be a problem. We just said before there was a minimum standard of a kazayit. This is low. Ein lo shiur lamalo, of a yesh lo shiur lamato. It has no maximum shiur, but it has a minimum shiur. So that's a little strange. The way Rashi explains it is that the minimum shear is a kazayit. So you can add as much as you want, or as much food as you want, you can add on top of that. The question is, why would you think otherwise? Why should there be any maximum? So many achronim try to explain that what it means is there's no shear the malo is either that there's no limit on the number of people that can rely on that kazayit for Erev Tavshilin, or others suggest there's no limit to the amount of food you can prepare on that one kazayit. So no matter how much food you need to prepare, once you started the preparation with that kazayit, that's enough to allow you to then prepare a huge meal afterwards. And so that's how they interpret this ein lo shiur lamalo, to make some sense of it. But that leaves us where we thought previously, which is that the Erev Tavshilin has a minimum shiur of a kazayit, and a maximum shiur of a kazayit, which is that it's not necessary to leave any more than a kazayit. And you can't have less than a kazayit, so a kazayit would work. Obviously, if you have more than a kazayit, it also would work, but it's not necessary to have more than a kazayit. And this braita will not be a problem for what we said previously. So now Gemara continues. Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav, Eruvei Tavshilin Tzrichim Dat. When it comes to Eruv Tavshilin, you need to have understanding or knowledge of the fact that you're making an Eruv Tavshilin. Pshita Dat Meniach Beinan. The person who's making the Eruv Tavshilin certainly needs to know that he's making Eruv Tavshilin, because otherwise then you have invested it with the power, quote-unquote, that you need in order to cook with it. It has to be something that you're preparing ahead of time, on which you're going to rely later on to continue cooking on Yom Tov for Shabbat. So if the person who makes the Eruv Tavshilin is not aware of that, then he's certainly not making an Eruv Tavshilin. You have to have awareness in order to carry the meaning or significance that you want from Eruv Tavshilin. The question is, dat mishin nicholo beinan olo beinan. Is someone who's going to rely on this Eruv Tavshilin, do they need to know that someone placed an Eruv Tavshilin on their behalf? So it's one thing, the person who's making the Eruv Tavshilin clearly needs to know. But do the people who are going to be beneficiaries of using this Eruv Tavshilin, do they need to know about it? So Tashma, Davud Shmuel, Mareva Kulin Narda. Davud Shmuel used to make an Eruv Tavshilin for the whole Narda. Anybody in Narda who had forgotten to make an Eruv Tavshilin, they could rely on Davud Shmuel's Eruv Tavshilin. Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Yassi, Marvu Kulu Taveria. Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Yassi used to make an Eruv for the entire Taveria. So it's clear here that they knew they were making Eruv Tavshilin, but the people relying on them weren't necessarily aware of that because they forgot to make an Eruv Tavshilin, or they didn't remember, and they said that you could rely on us for their Eruv Tavshilin. So the fact that they can rely on them, even though they didn't have foreknowledge of the fact that there was an Eruv Tavshilin, shows you that you don't need the people who are going to be the beneficiaries of the Eruv Tavshilin to know that the Eruv Tavshilin is being placed on their behalf up front. They'll have to know at some point, because otherwise they can't cook without there being an Eruv Tavshilin. But at least up front, they may not know, but you have to be aware of that. Machriz Rabbi Yaakov Baidi, Mishlo Niach Eruv Tavshilin, Yavo Mismoch Al Shalit. He used to announce in his city that anybody who didn't make an Eruv Tavshilin could come and rely on mine. You could read the proof text in both directions. One is that the fact that Rav Yaakov Be'idi makes an announcement that you can rely on mine shows you that people maybe need to know about it. Although on the other hand, Avuah Shmuel and Rav Yami and Rasi never make an explicit announcement, but it's clear that they have to let people know because people can't rely on it unless they know that it exists. And therefore, that would indicate the opposite, that they didn't need to know ahead of time, but they did need to know in the end before they cooked or baked for Shabbat, that there was an Eruv Tavshilin placed for them. So they didn't need to know at the time that it was placed, but they do need to know at a later time. And so that may be the proof in the opposite direction, which is that you don't need them to have that knowledge. And that's the way we hold the halacha, which is that they don't need to know, vad kama, how far is the perimeter of area that can rely on Rav Yaakov Be'idi, and Rav Nuchumi Bar Zechai Mishum Abaye ad Tchum Shabbat. Until Tchum Shabbat, that's a reasonable amount of space that will be covered by this Eruv Tavshilin. That's because when Rav Yaakov Be'idi or any of these Chachamim put down the Eruv Tavshilin on behalf of their city, they were thinking of anybody who's within the limits of their city. They're not thinking of people outside the limits of their city. And for that reason, Rishonim point out that if someone makes an Eruv Tchumin and then comes into the Tchum on Yom Tov, they would not be covered by the Eruv Tavshilin, because the people putting down the Eruv Tavshilin are only considering or thinking about people in their sphere of influence on that Yom Tov or Shabbat. And those are people who are found inside their tchum. So the fact that other people will come from the outside, they don't have awareness of that. They're not thinking about that, and therefore they're not included in the Eruv. As Rashi says, Lomdim chuz l'tchum, lo yadato sheminiach aleihem. The person who's placing the Eruv didn't have them in mind, and therefore they're not covered by that Eruv Tavshilin. How Samya Davi Misader Matnita Kameh Demar Shmuel. There was this blind individual who used to review Mishnayot. He knew them by heart. He used to review them in front of Shmuel, help him to review all the Mishnayot. Chazid Abayotziv, it was on Yom Tov, and Shmuel saw that he was upset. Rashi over here says that it was Rosh Hashanah. And since it was Rosh Hashanah, he couldn't put down an Eruv Tavshilin all tonight, which we'll see is a mechanism that you can use to put down an Eruv Tavshilin. When you have Shnei Yomim Tovim Shel Galiot, you can make a condition and put it down on the first and second day, and then one of those 2 days is Chol, and therefore you either do or do not need an Eruv Tavshilin, and it would work. But by Rosh Hashanah, which Kedusha Achat, you can't do that. You don't have the ability to make that tonight. And that's why he didn't have the ability now to make an Eruv Tavshilin on Yom Tov itself. Amalei Amayat Sivat. So Shmuel sees him and says, why are you upset? Amalei Dlo TV Eruvei Tavshilin. I didn't put down an Eruv Tavshilin. Now I'm not going to be able to prepare from Yom Tov to Shabbat. Amalei Samocha Didi. Rely on my Eruv Tavshilin. So it was a Thursday, Friday, Shabbat situation of Rosh Hashanah. And so he wanted to prepare on Friday for Rosh Hashanah, and he can't do this Eruv Tavshilin out tonight. So Shmuel says, don't worry about it. I put one down for the entire city, and therefore you can rely on my Eruv Tavshilin. The Shana, in the following year, Chazi Davi Yotziv, he saw the same thing again. It's a Thursday, Friday, Shabbat, Rosh Hashanah, and this blind individual is in front of Shmuel, is upset again. I forgot to put an Erev Tavshilin again. You are negligent. And therefore, everybody else can rely on my Erev Tavshilin. But for you, it's problematic. Now the question is, why exactly is it problematic for him? If Shmuel put down an Erev Tavshilin for the whole city, why isn't this individual covered by that? According to Rashi, I'm not looking to cover people who do it intentionally or are negligent. Because they're not careful about the mitzvot of the chachamim. So that leads Rishonim and Achronim to speculate about exactly what he was doing wrong. Some say that he wasn't fastidious with regards to mitzvot of the chachamim. Therefore, Shmuel, on the first time, saw it as an accident. But when he repeated it again, he saw this as being a pattern of behavior where this individual wasn't careful with a mitzvot of chachamim. And therefore, he penalized him by saying, you're not covered by this because you don't take care of the mitzvot of the chachamim. Others suggest the fact that he was upset about not putting an Eruv down means that he wasn't relying on Shmuel's Eruv, and therefore he couldn't benefit from Shmuel's Eruv because the fact that he's upset meant that he basically disassociated himself from the Eruv of Shmuel because he wanted to have his own Eruv, and therefore Shmuel's Eruv is not going to cover him in that situation. The first year where it was a mistake, or he thought it was a mistake, then he said, okay, you can cover, follow my Eruv. The second year already, it became more obvious that he didn't want to rely on Shmuel's Eruv because he knew about that now, and he still didn't rely on it, he was still upset. So that meant that he was rejecting Shmuel's Eruv, and therefore he couldn't rely on Shmuel's Eruv. Or the simplest maybe interpretation is the fact that it happened again showed that this individual was not being careful with the mitzvot. He wasn't being careful about his Eruv Tavshilin. So it's one thing to rely on the Rav's Erev Tavshilin when you make a mistake. But if you keep making the mistake, that shows no longer that it's a mistake, but rather it's a pattern of behavior that indicates either lack of interest in doing the mitzvot properly in consideration for mitzvot of Chachamim, or a person who is now going to rely on others because they're lazy and not taking care of it. And to that Shmuel says, now you can't rely on my Eruv because your behavior belies problematic intent and problematic attitude towards the mitzvot of the Chachamim. And that happens to be the way that the halacha is, that in cases where you do need Erev Tavshilin, usually the Rav of the city or the Rav of the Yishuv makes an Erev Tavshilin for the entire community. And again, if somebody forgets, then they can rely on the Rav for their Erev Tavshilin. If it becomes a pattern of behavior where a person starts to indicate that they're not going to make an Erev Tavshilin and they keep relying on the Rav, then that's problematic unless they specify ahead of time that they want to be a part of the Rav's Erev Tavshilin and not just rely on the fact that he's doing it on their behalf. And now the Gemara continues, Tana Rabbanan, Yom Tov Shechol Yot Be'erev Shabbat. You have Yom Tov that's before Shabbat. Eim Arvin, Lo Eruvei Tchumin, Lo Eruvei Chatzerot. You're not allowed to make an Erev Tchumim on Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. And not an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. That's the Tana Kama's view. Rabbi Omer, Marvin Eruvei Chatzerot. You can make an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov for Shabbat. Avelo Eruvei Tchumin. But not make an Erev Tchumin. Mipnei. You can restrict him in something that he can't do. But you can't restrict him in something that he's permitted to do. So the way that Rabbi explains his logic is that when it comes to Isur Tchumim are equally applicable to Shabbat and to Yom Tov. And since they're equally applicable to Shabbat and Yom Tov, then there's a problem of Tchum on Yom Tov. So then we don't allow you to engage in the activity that would be Usur on Yom Tov to do. You'd have to solve that before Yom Tov. We don't allow you to engage in that activity, prepare for Shabbat, to free up your tchumin or change your tchum when it comes to Shabbat. On the other hand, when it comes to Erev Chatzerot, there's no problem of carrying on Yom Tov. That's not something that's asur. So since it's not something that's asur and you don't need an Erev Chatzerot for Yom Tov, then you also can prepare an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov for Shabbat, because you're not engaging in an activity that is asur or something that's problematic on Yom Tov, and therefore you're permitted to do it on Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. And even though, as Tosfos points out, Rabbi's of the opinion that Yom Tov and Shabbat are Kedusha Achat, so then how could you make an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov to Shabbat? So Tosfos says, Enochanami, that's exactly what Rabbi's pointing out, which is that Kedusha Achat applies to things that are Asur on Yom Tov, then they're going to be Asur to prepare on Yom Tov for Shabbat. Since they're Kedusha Achat, you need to take care of it before Yom Tov in order that it'll be influential or impactful on Shabbat, because you can't do it on Yom Tov itself. Whereas if it's something that's Mutar on Yom Tov, then Kedusha Achat doesn't apply because it's not something that is a common denominator between them. If that doesn't apply, then you can do it on Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. So as far as the halacha is concerned, Itmar Rav Amar Halacha Ketana Kamol, So halacha is like the Tana Kama, they're both restricted. Ushmal Amar, halacha ki Rabbi. And Shmuel says halacha is like Rabbi, and we pass him like Rab because this is Isurei. When it comes to Isurim, the halacha is like Rab, and therefore we'll pass him like Rab, who says like the Tana Kama, that you can't make an Erev Tchumim, and you can't make Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. Ibailu, halacha ki Rabbi l'kula, or l'chumra. When Shmuel says over here, the halacha is like Rabbi, is he saying that Rabbi is l'kula or l'chumra? Where it says, Pshita de l'kula kamar. What's the question? We saw the Braita before, Rabbi was l'kula. So if Shmuel saying the halacha is like Rabbi, obviously means the Rabbi, l'kula. Bishom, we have a problem because there's another version of this machloket. And that's what creates this uncertainty. Deshalach Rabbi Elazar l'gula. Belazar from Eretz Yisrael sent to the Gola to Bavel. Lokesh atem shonim be'Bavel. The way that you have this machloket set up in the Braita in Bavel is incorrect. Rabbi Matir v'chachamim Musrim. That's what we have in our version of the Braita. The Rabbi is the one who's the Kula, and the Chachamim, or the Tanakama, is Osir. Ella, the way that the version we have in Eretz Yisrael is that Rebbe is the Osir. Rebbe's like the Tanakama, who says you can't make an Erev Chatzirot, and you can't make an Erev Tchumin on Yom Tov for Shabbat. V'chachamim Matirim, and the Chachamim allow, not an Erev Tchumin, but at least Erev Chatzirot, they do allow on Yom Tov to Shabbat. So my. So then when Shmuel says halacha is like Rabbi, which version was he referencing to? Was he referencing to the version in Bavel? And that means that Rabbi's the Kula and he's passing like Rabbi the Kula. Or is he referencing the version in Eretz Yisrael where Rabbi's the Chumra and he's saying halacha is like Rabbi, the Chumra? Tashma, the Rav Tachlifa Barav Dime, Abad Uvda Kavatei de Shmuel. So Rav Tachlifa Barav Dime followed this psak of Shmuel. Vama Rav, and Rav who clearly disagreed because Rav paskin against Shmuel in this situation, the beginning of this first psak of this young Talmud Chacham is wrong, and it's going to cause people to violate Yom Tov in preparation for Shabbat. So, if Rashmo's psak is the kula, hainu kilkula. That's the kilkula, that's the problem that he's creating. He paskins the kula like his Rebbe Shmuel, and he paskins like Rabbi, who says that you're allowed to make an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov Shabbat. And Rav is saying about this person, he's going to cause people to be mekalkel, to do the wrong thing. Because now they're going to come to make an Erev Chatzerot on Yom Tov to Shabbat, which doesn't really work according to Rav. And since it doesn't work, now they're going to carry on Shabbat, depending on that Erev Chatzerot. If you think that it's like the version Eretz Yisrael, where Rabbi says they're both Asur, if he's being machmir, and people are going to not make an Erev Chatzerot, and I'm Erev Tchumin, what's the kilkul? What problem did he cause people? When you go to Chumra, not always, but in general, it's a conservative, protective stance, and then Rav could disagree with them, but it doesn't mean that he's going to be a Mekalka, he's not causing people to do the wrong thing. So where it says, came into Mekalka about Rabim, Haino Kilkula. It's going to cause people in public or in general to do the wrong thing, which is, Shoshokachin, Mutatulim below Eruv. Because people are not going to put down an Erev Chetzerot. They're going to forget they didn't put down an Erev Chetzerot. And they're going to carry on Shabbat. Had he told them that it was mutar to put down an Erev Chatzerot, they would have remembered and done it. And then when they carry on Shabbat, they'd be covered by the Erev Chatzerot they put down. But now that he's telling them it's also to put on Erev Chatzerot, now when they forget and carry on Shabbat, they're going to be carrying without an Erev Chatzerot. And that's the kukul that he was creating. And that is what leaves us uncertain as to whether Shmuel is passing like Rabbi Lekula or the Chumra. But then we have Amarava, Amarav, Chista, Amaravuna, Halacha Karabi, Vile Esor. The halacha is like Rabbi, and that is lesor, like the Chumra side, or in essence, that would be the same way as we saw before, Rav paskening like the Tana Kama, and now Shmuel, who's paskening like Rabbi, therefore the halacha is like that, which is it's also to make an Erev Chatzerot or an Erev Tchumin on Yom Tov going into Shabbat. Okay, we're going to stop here, two lines down on the top of Yud Zayin Amud Aleph.